Last week I talked about what description logics are and why we have any of them. But the question, what do we do with these things? What are some of the questions? Given that we've got a knowledge base that's done with an assertion box and a terminology box and so on, what can we do with it? And this basic set of questions, and this is really the most fundamental one. We've got two concepts. Now, these are concept expressions, not just concept names. So you can say, well, is this one a special case of that one? Is that definitely true, definitely false? Might we not know yet. Now, if we've got this one, we can ask, is our knowledge base satisfiable? Could there be a model of it? Now, given a concept, could there be any instances of that concept? So could there be something which is a male-female dog? Okay. So if a particular concept, which is, again, that's a concept expression, is provably subsumed by the empty concept, then it can't have any instances. Otherwise, if it's false, then there's something that we definitely know is in the concept, and then there must be something, or we might simply not have enough information to tell. Concept equivalence, it's just like equivalence in normal logic. Disjointness. It all hangs on assumption. If the conjunction of two concepts has to be empty, then the two concepts are disjoint. Now, classification we've got a whole bunch of concepts, right? And okay, we'd like to form a nice big diagram. So where do they all fit? And in particular, historically, classification meant, hey, we've got a new concept. Where does that fit in our existing diagram? So you could do things like start at the top and basically do a sort of binary search then to see if you could find a place for it. It's a pretty badly keyhole, isn't it? Now, you might say, surely this is pretty obvious. But it isn't. In particular, sometimes we have these chains. I've just drawn a chain here with two elements. Okay, we've only just got started. Sometimes we have chains where we've got things that we intended to be. And somebody says, well, a C is a D, and somebody else says, well, D is a C, and you've got two things which you meant to be different. And they get identified like this. And you didn't know that, you didn't ask about that, but it turns up. Now, just last night, getting my head ready for today's lecture, I was reading quite a lot of papers about some of this stuff. To be honest, skimming quite a lot of papers about this stuff. One of the things I hoped I would have time for this year, there is a big thing called SNOMED CT. And it's mentioned in the notes, but it really wants to be mentioned here. Standard Nomenclature of Medical Terms, Clinical Terminology, I think, is what it stands for. SNOMED. And this is gigantic. It's if you look at papers, they'll say it's got more than 300,000 concepts. I asked about the possible, I wanted to get this thing so we could show it to you. And the international organization that manages it said, oh, the university really has a license. And so I asked around, and there were people who wanted to use it but didn't have it, and there was somebody who had it and was just an administrator, and it wasn't. So I ended up getting the current version. And unfortunately, it turns out that when you get the current version of SnowMed, what you get is the data files. What you do not get is documentation that tells you how they will work. So I have with all this data, but I don't know how to make sense of it yet. But it's big. Okay. Now, when I talk about a concept here, in fact, within SnowMed, they've got so many concepts, they do not name the concepts by words. The concepts are actually numbers. And there are mappings from these numbers to several human languages. I've got the mapping to English. I think. I may not find it yet, but I think I've got it. There's also mappings to things like Spanish and French and so on. There's also a mapping to the International Classification of Diseases, which is fairly approximate. But one of the papers I was reading last night was about errors in SnowMed, where concepts have been put in the wrong order. For example, people building this, and by now they're up to about 600,000 concepts. I mean, this is a huge number. The people who did this review of the SnowMed errors did it in part by reference to their own system called Linkbase, which has about 1 million concepts, and they are adding or changing 1,000 to 2,000 a day. Okay, their concept base is actually very dynamic. And people get muddled about which way around to put things. And they get confused about their own terminology. For example, in the UK, when a doctor talks about your leg, they tend to mean the whole leg. And in the US, apparently, when a doctor talks about your leg, they tend to mean the part below the knee. And the part above the knee, they tend to call the thigh. Now, when you've got a concept base being built initially by collaboration between the UK and the US, things like this cause problems. There are places that assume that thigh and leg are disjoint, and there are places that assume that thigh is part of leg. Okay. So one of the reasons why, you know, classifying, why automatically organizing things and pointing out loops and stuff, one of the reasons why that's valuable is people make mistakes. If you've got a knowledge base which is large enough to need specialized techniques to handle it, you've got a knowledge base which is large enough to need specialized techniques to debug it. Consistency checking, can we conclude that some individual both is and is not a member of a concept? Can we conclude that a particular pair of things both are and are not in some relationship? And so on. Classifying individuals, that's the same thing. No, it's not quite the same thing. This says, is there any individual and any concept which both is and isn't? Here we're saying, is this individual part of this concept? And we're talking about a particular individual. So we can reduce classification for individuals to subsumption of concepts. Okay. If we've got an assertion that says this individual belongs to this concept, take them all together and ask whether that conjunction is subsumed by the concept of individuals. But another thing that we do is we say, well, find me all X which belong to a particular concept. And this is a database query, right? We're saying we've got facts about individuals. Find me an answer to a query. Or we can ask about find pairs of individuals that are in some role. All of these are slight variations, but the whole point is that these are things people need to do. Given an individual with a set of concepts, find the most specific concept that individual belongs to. Now, here's the thing that perhaps somebody might do. Somebody comes in and they've got skin cancer on their right thigh. What do we call that? Okay. There's a whole bunch of things we can say about this individual. What is the most specific term in our knowledge base that covers that? Now, that's more what people do with the International Classification of Diseases.
somebody comes in with some particular condition, let's say it's a burn on the left hand, there's a code for that. If it's on the right hand, there's a different code. If it's on the forearm, there's a different code. Okay. So this person's about saying, here's an individual, here's some of the things we know about it. What do we call that? That's actually one of the major tasks that SNOMED and ICD-10 and so on are used for. Now, with one of the reasons why people got interested in SNOMED, ICD-10 is just a set of facts in a book. With SNOMED, you can actually put in the facts about the case and have the classification pop out. What do we call this? How do we record it so that everybody's using the same thing? Okay, so these are the things that we want to do. And what does it mean to say we want to do this on a computer? It means we want an algorithm. We like these tasks to be decidable. If it's not decidable, you don't have an algorithm. Now, one of the first languages, I said I was going to give you two, I'm actually going to give you three. 50% extra. I keep going to scroll back on this. It's okay, here's a language called AL. Now, you're going to think, isn't this a bit boring, just lists of stuff? Okay, one of the things about this, one of the things I want you to come away from this lecture knowing is that there's a whole lot of little modules of logic, each of which is useful. And we can't have everything. If we throw everything in, it's going to be intractable. It's going to be hard. Too hard for the computer. So what we have to do in practice is say, which of these bits do we absolutely have to need? For our particular application. For example, there's the numeric quantifiers things. If we don't need them, keep them out. If we put too much in, it's going to be too hard. And the thing is, there isn't a best answer. Okay. It'd be nice if I could say, here is the description logic, which is best for all known uses. If you add one more thing to it, it'll all go pear-shaped. No, you can say, well, look, here's something. We can add this to it. Or we can add that to it, but we can't add both. So if we need that bit, then we use that logic. And if we need this bit, we use this other extension. And it's a pain in the neck. It really is. And it's just amazing. If you read the papers, it's just amazing how what seems like a tiny change, and you'll see this, but you're not going to see the proof, because I don't understand the proof yet. You're going to see this in this lecture. Just a tiny change, what looks like a tiny change, can mean the difference between tractability and intractability. So we push hard on this, we get people to prove theorems about it, and time again, people thought they had something which was, hey, this is a great compromise, and then, oops, sorry, that's too strong. So what does AL have? We've got the top concept that covers everything. We've got the bottom concept that covers nothing. We've got atomic concepts. These are things that are primitive names, basically. And you can negate an atomic concept, but you can't negate anything else. We don't need to negate true. We don't need to negate top because we've got bottom. We don't need to negate bottom because we've got top. But we can't negate an intersection, a conjunction. So we've got conjunction. We've got limited existential. Now, the limited existential, you can say, you're saying the set of things that are in the relation are just something, but I'm not saying anything about the something. Okay. And the value restriction says the set of things such that everything they're related to by R belongs to this other concept. C and D
here are concept expressions, not concept names. A is just a concept name. So we don't have union. We can't say something that is a dog or a budgie. We can't negate anything but an atomic concept. So we can't form the concept a person that has no pet. Okay, that would be person and not exists pet. Sorry, not exists tense. We can't do that because you're not allowed to apply negation to the existential thing there. We could actually say a person such that everything they tend is not a pet, and that would indirectly, it's one of these, it's almost as bad as we're using SQL. Time after time using SQL, you find yourself saying, oh, I can't say what I want to say. Can I turn this inside out? You know, applying mathematical laws. The real problem when you do this with SQL is that the mathematical laws don't hold. With AL, they do hold. One thing in particular, a role here is just a role name. You're not allowed to use composition of roles, you're not allowed to use inverse of roles, you're not allowed to use anything on roles. Now, this is the concept language, and then you can add in your assertions about things being subsumed or equivalent. You can extend AL in various ways. And there's a systematic naming convention for them. You've got U for union, E for existential, where you've got a general concept here, N for general negation, and N for number restrictions, and C for general complements. So we can add this, we can add that's the union, the square cup. For existential quantification, the difference here is it just top where you're saying there is something that we're related to, or are you allowed to say something more about what you're related to? Number restrictions, at least n things in a row. That was supposed to be less than or equal to there. Now, the thing about this is, I've said here N and I meant C. Okay, I'm sorry. I kept getting muddled up. I mean, N should mean negation, right? Okay. No, sorry. Before I tell you where to find this, I will fix this. Complements implies union. Why is that? In particular, if we do not A, and not B, so if we've got complement and intersection, we get union. If you've got complement and union, you get intersection. Also, if you've got these two, it turns out that we've got complement and the proof there is by repeatedly expanding things out to a negation normal form. What's negation normal form? We haven't covered that because we haven't been talking about how you write a program to prove things. But negation normal form is where you take a formula that contains negation and you use laws like this to push the negations all the way down to the leaves. And it turns out that if we've only got existentials, if we had an intersection, we wouldn't be able to do that. Negation, but if you're allowed to have union, you can turn intersection into union and into or. So putting something in a negation normal form. We can do this. So, in practice, the combination UE is abbreviated as C, and ALC is a description logic we'll find fairly often. So I've got to fix that. Now, here's an example of using AL. It is my text again. Here we go. We've got person, pet, dog, bird, male, and female. We've got tens. So we can say this. Every person is something such that everything it tends is a pet. We can also say, if something tends something, it's a person. So what I want to say is that the domain of tens is person, and the range of tens is pet, but I can't say that directly. I can say it indirectly. So this one I'm saying, I can say that the domain of tens is person. Okay. So if something is such that it tends something, then it is a person. So we could extend our assertion language that we can use here, but with domain of tens is contained in person by macro expansion to this. This we can't quite do. I can't say if anything tends something, then that thing is a pet. I can't say that. I can only say if a person tends something, then that thing is a pet. I can say person and pet are disjoint, dog is a pet, bird is a pet, dog and bird are disjoint, male and female are disjoint, and then I can give these things as before, Richard is a male person, Lily is a female dog, bird is a, Jazzy is a female bird, and Shazzy is a female bird, and so on. Now, one thing about this is that this is now redundant. Because I've got Richard tends Lily, I tend to something, therefore I must be a person. So we could just leave that bit out and get the same effect. And that's actually quite important in practice. Why? Because, you know, if you've got a large knowledge base and people keep on adding and revising facts and rules to the tune of 1,000 or so a day, when you add a fact, you may not know everything that could be relevant. Somebody may introduce a whole new set of concepts that you should be, that this thing should be part of. You want to be able to infer, you want to be able to say, well, if this information ever made sense, then we can infer these new things about it that we're talking about now but we weren't talking about back then. So, I don't think we've really got time for an example there. Now, the interesting thing about ALC is that ALC is decidable. Satisfiability is decidable for ALC, and therefore subsumption is decidable. And they've found a number of extensions of ALC through which it's possible to get sound and complete algorithms. Soundness, everything you infer from true assumptions is true. Completeness, everything that is true you can infer. If you had to give up soundness or completeness, one or the other, which one would you prefer to give up?
What are the definitions again?
Soundness, if you infer it, it's true. Completeness, if it's true, you can infer it. Right. And here's why I'm happy to give up completeness. Gödel's famous theorem.
if you've got an extension of logic which is rich enough to talk about the whole numbers, there are truths that you can't prove. Any system that's rich enough to include logic and whole number arithmetic, and I'm talking about just positive whole number, non-negative whole number arithmetic, is rich enough that you can't prove everything. There are more true things than provable things. So I'm not that upset if there are things that are true but can't be proved. I want consistency. I want soundness. I want if it is provable, it's true. But completeness, I'm willing to pass on. But when you can, now, what does completeness here? Completeness is relative not to full logic. It's relative to these logics. In particular, it's relative to the open world assumption, the non-unique name assumption. So ALC cannot, ALC without number restrictions cannot prove that I have exactly three pairs. Which is good, because there was a time when we did have a goldfish. Actually, two goldfish. I haven't said anything about them, so the fact that you can't conclude that they don't exist is good. Okay, because it wouldn't have been sound in the real world. But, okay, so this is... what's a transitive role? It's something like ancestor. Parent is not transitive. I'm the parent of Abigail. Nolan is parent of me. Nolan is not Abigail's parent. I am an ancestor of Abigail. Nolan is ancestor of me. Nolan is an ancestor of Abigail. So ancestor is transitive and parent is not. And one of the reasons why people are very interested in transitive roles is, it's called, there's a fancy name for it, mereology, mereology, the logic of the part-whole relationship, or the contained-in relationship. And so, for example, I mentioned lead. I mean, the fact about English doctors tending to refer to the whole leg as the leg, and American doctors tending to refer to the thigh and the leg, meaning the lower leg. Okay. Now, what we've got here is a part-whole relationship. We've got leg is part of human being, thigh is part of leg, lower leg is part of leg. You know, and there are various bones and muscles and things in their parts as well. So we've got this part, and okay. Toe is part of a foot. Whether you want to call foot part of the leg depends on choice, really. Do we call... Okay. Now, one of the things here, by the way, is that there is a reality and there are concepts. Concepts are in our heads. What does ringaringa mean in Maori? Means hand and forearm. We've got a word hand. If you go into a toilet and it says what is it, horoi or ku ringaringa, wash your hands. It's actually saying wash your hands and forearms. But the English sign saying wash your hands is saying just wash your hands. So, different languages carve up the world in different ways. There is a physical reality here. This thing, and I'm here, here is one hand. Sorry, insider joke. Here is one hand. It's really there. Here is a ringa-ringa. It's really there. And hand is part of ringa-ringa. And these hands are part of... Okay. But however you carve it up, toe is part of foot, and foot is part of lower limb, and lower limb is part of me,
And toe is part of me. Okay. Part of is like ancestor, not like parent. And when you're devising an ontology to talk about bodies, and SNOMED has been used for veterinary medicine as well as human medicine, and they've got their own linguistic peculiarities as well, the part-whole relationship does actually matter here. And we've actually got two kinds of part-whole relationship. We've got functional systems, and we've got physical containment. So, for example, veins are part of our circulatory system, but they're also a particular vein will be part of the body part that it's inside. So we've got functional part, and then you get onto things like the biochemistry. We've got two things might be part of a particular reaction cycle. Okay. So transitive roles and transitive closures of roles are quite important for describing medical data. And the gene ontology. There's this huge ontology of known genes and their functions and how they connect together. This thing promotes that thing, this thing represses that thing, and so on. And there's a lot of work going on to this, and we're using very simple logical systems to talk about gigantic sets of facts, and it's no accident. We're using the richest logical systems that we can afford. ALC is a good sort of core case of something that is decidable. And there was much joy when it was discovered that ALC has decidable algorithms for all of these things that we want to do. But decidable is not the same as tractable. And at this point, I want to write something on the board, and I hope I can remember it correctly. Some of the standard complexity classes. P is the class of problems that can be solved on a Turing machine in polynomial time. Now, this actually implies that it takes polynomial space, because in order to touching a piece of space is going to take at least one unit of time. So if you talk exponential amount of space, you would have to take exponential amount of time just to look at it. Okay. So we've got things that can be done in polynomial time by a deterministic Turing machine. NP is the things that can be done in polynomial time by a non-deterministic Turing machine. That's one that's allowed to make guesses and by sheer supernatural magic make the right guess every time. Okay. So non-deterministic polynomial time. And One way of thinking about it is, if somebody gave you an answer, you could check that it was an answer in polynomial time. I've mentioned this before, I think, with propositional calculus. It's clear that propositional calculus is in the NP class, because if somebody gave us the formula and an interpretation for that formula, we could check that the formula was true in that model in linear time. But that doesn't mean we can find things. So check in polynomial time, find in exponential time, Probably. P-space, this is the class of things that can be done in a polynomial amount of space, but not polynomial time. And some of these things are known to be in any strict inequalities, and some of them aren't. P equals NP is the big question mark. So exp time is the class of problems that can be solved in exponential time on a Turing machine and cannot be solved in less time than that. And there are such things. There's even worse things than this. Nexp time is the things we're checking takes exponential time. Nobody knows if these two things are equal. But these two definitely aren't. These two definitely aren't, I think. And these two definitely aren't. And exp space is where it requires exponential space. Normally, as programmers, we get worried when we discover that something's in NP. Can't show that it's in P, because that means that the best algorithm anybody knows is going to take time exponential in the size of the problem for some problem. So the satisfiable ability from here is NP complete. What about this? Well, it's decidable, yes, but it's not polynomial time. By the way, if you want to achieve undying fame in computer science, prove P equals NP one way or the other. Do that, and you may well be worshipped as a god. So what do we do when something is NP complete or worse? Well, one thing is just to put up with it and hope. So what people do with ALC is they write programs and they do all kinds of clever programming tricks. They make the program as efficient as they can, and they just hope that they're not going to hit any hard problems. Now, this actually works quite well in practice. There's lots of problems where people basically just hope it's not going to turn out bad. The satisfiability problem for Boolean logic, for propositional logic, is one of those problems where people basically do the best they can and just hope. Modern satisfiability programs have really achieved a state that I would never have believed 20 years ago. People are routinely solving problems with thousands of variables. And how does this work when it's NP hard? NP complete, sorry. How does it work? Well, it works because we don't actually construct random problems. We don't exhaustively construct problems. We construct problems that have some sort of special structure which the programs are able to exploit, sometimes even when we can't spell out what the structure is. And this is one of the things people do. They say, okay, we'll take an algorithm. We know that the worst case is exponential. We'll do the best we can. We'll just hope that it works. And if it runs, if you can't get an answer in a day, give up. Do something else. Change the problem. And, you know, ultimately, we may have to do that. Another approach is that people use some sort of approximation. So, for example, the satisfiability problem says we've got the conjunction of all of these formulas. The hard problem is make them all true. What happens if we say make most of them true?
Make as many of them as you can true. Well, you know, so the answer is not going to be the perfect thing, but maybe you can live with a few of these clauses. Maybe some of these clauses are more important than others. Okay, so for example, if you're a city council and you're administering a district plan, you've got all sorts of rules. You might have rules that say, well, things must be in particular colours, or things may only be a certain height, or there are certain permitted activities. And some of these things may be more important than other things. If you're desperate to encourage business, and the only problem is that this business needs a building that's a metre or two too big, you might say, well, we'll pass you on this one. Okay. Approximation algorithms is a large body of study. There's a whole lot of algorithms, a whole lot of problems, where people say, well, okay, let me tell you about one of them. The travelling salesman. What you've got here, you've got somebody who has to visit a number of cities, and there are transport routes between these cities. And you might be concerned with distance, or you might be concerned with cost, but let's say it's cost. You're interested in the price of travelling between A and B. What you want to do is you want to find a tour that visits all the cities that you need to visit at minimum cost. Very natural, very simple sort of thing to do. When you've got a computer-controlled tool that's wiring up a circuit board, okay, you want to use a minimum amount of wire, and you want the thing to take a minimum amount of time. You want it to move around. You don't want to go backwards and forwards all the time. Another example of this is... when I was doing my master's, I used a plotter. Now, the university had bought a plotter, a thing that drew graphs on paper, a computer-controlled thing that drew graphs on paper. And it was, if you took two of these tables and put them side by side, that was how big it was. Okay, so you spread out a big sheet of paper on the thing, you turned on the motors, and the vacuum sucked the paper down, made it nice and flat. And then there was this head that moved around, picked up pens, pens went up and down and up and down, jigging around. You wanted to get this done in a reasonable amount of time. You did not want that head to move any more than it had to, but there were some number of lines that had to be drawn. Again, this is a version of the traveling salesman problem. And this is one of the standard hard problems. Nobody knows how to find the optimum in less than exponential time. People have got some very, very clever algorithms that can cope with a couple of thousand points. But they are still pretty bad when you can get much past that. But if you say, I will accept a tour that is up to twice as bad as the best achievable, then you can do it in polynomial time. You can do it really fast if you're prepared to put up with a solution that isn't the best possible. So there's a lot of problems like that where people use an approximation. They say, well, if we can get within a specified factor of the best, we'll put up with not being able to get the best because we might never get the best. Another approach is a different kind of approximation. You have an algorithm that makes essential use of random numbers, and it has some probability of failing to find an answer. So it might succeed or it might not succeed. And if it doesn't succeed, you have to try it again with different random numbers. Now, here's a method that's been used with Boolean formulas. And you've got your formula as a set of clauses. It goes like this. Pick a random model. Just flip it. For each variable, flip a coin. And now you count the number of clauses that are true. If they're all true, you're done. If they're not all true, you're going to have to change something. So consider each variable. For each variable, if I flipped this variable, this many clauses would turn from false into true, and that many clauses would turn from true into false. So you take that difference. Would it increase the total number of true clauses by this much? Would it decrease the total number of clauses by that much? And you pick, if while there is a variable that you could flip that would increase the number of true clauses, pick one of them and flip it. Now, that may sound crazy, and it certainly has a non-zero probability of getting stuck without finding a satisfying interpretation, even when there is one. But if you just repeat it over and over again with different starting points, you can drive that probability down as low as you like. And this is, in fact, an algorithm. There are several more sophisticated versions of the algorithm, but they still rely essentially on randomization, and they have a probability of failing. Now, I feel I'm comfortable with things that have some probability of not giving you an answer. But, you know, think about it. There's a non-zero probability that you'll be killed by a meteorite in the next few minutes. If the probability of getting no answer is less than the probability that you won't be there to get it, should you care very much? And I was actually taught that lesson by somebody who worked at an English computer manufacturer called ICL, and they had made a special purpose database system, and it relied on hashing to do joins. It was doing it in the hardware. And the hardware hash table they used had a certain probability of failing. And I asked him, you know, how come? Why do you tolerate this hash table having some probability of failing? And he said, well, the probability that the hash table will fail is much less than the probability that the disk will fail. Nobody will notice. It's not going to make any practical difference. So probabilistic algorithms, you know, if the choice is an algorithm that will give you an answer with 99% probability in 5 minutes, and an algorithm that will give you an answer only when the universe has decayed into quarks floating in a vacuum, what are you going to choose? Another approach is to say, can we look for some sort of restriction that our problems will satisfy, such that a specialized algorithm that exploits that restriction can actually do it better? And we use all of these strategies. Okay. Now, I'm laboring this thing because this is a computer science department. Complexity is one of the fundamental concepts of our discipline, and dealing with it is one of the fundamental problems of our practice. And it is just amazing how many problems turn out to be hard. Let me give you an example. I actually used HTML for this. I would have preferred to use LaTeX, but I wanted to put this up as a web page. Now, in LaTeX, there is an optimal algorithm for dividing a sequence of words into lines to make a paragraph, breaking a paragraph into lines. Knuth published the algorithm in Software Practice and Experience. It's a dynamic programming algorithm, and it takes linear time, and it's brilliant. It revolutionized the quality of computer typesetting. Well, if you can break a paragraph into lines, can you use a similar algorithm to break a sequence of lines into pages? And Donald Knuth had a student, I can't remember his first name, a Mr. Plass, we should say Dr. Plass because he got his PhD, and he said to Plass, okay, here's the problem, I can break a paragraph into lines optimally. I've just got an ad hoc technique for breaking lines into pages. Can you do something along these? Can you do something like this for that problem? And in the end, Plass spent more than half of his thesis looking at different formulations of what the problem was and proving that each of them was NP-hard. I mean, there are little things like this thing doesn't actually have any good. If you've got a figure, you would like to have a figure or a table either on the page that refers to it or on the facing page. Putting that in as a constraint makes the problem intractable. So at the end, he did provide an algorithm, and the algorithm does not do a whole bunch of things he'd really like it to do. And the answer is it doesn't do them because it can't. He chose a restricted problem, he chose a restriction that made the problem solvable. And that's what we're doing with description logics. We're looking for something that's restricted so that we know it can be done. Now, the subsumption thing for AL and ALC is decidable, but it's exponential. There is a description logic in which it's polynomial time, and that's where EL comes in. Okay. This is the point of EL. EL is a very, very simple description logic, but most of the things that we want to do with it can be done in polynomial time, that is to say, efficiently.
Efficiently. So here it is. That's all there is to it. We've got top, we don't have bottom. That should have been a capital A, sorry. We've got atomic concepts, names, we've got a conjunction of concepts, and we've got the existential restriction. Now, this is not the same as anything in ALC, at least in AL. In AL, we've got existential with a role and top, and we've got universal with a role and a concept. Here we've got existential with a role and a concept. And if we look back to this, since top is a concept, we can say this, but we can't say that. In EL, we cannot say everything that a person tends is a pet. We can't even do it by tricks with negation because we don't have negation. Okay. So basically, the way something like EL guarantees that subsumption can be done in polynomial time is by preventing you from saying the things that make it hard. So, our terminology axiom is basically just a subsumption thing. It's very weak. But there's an interesting thing going on here. What have we got in terms of logic? We've got and, or conjunction, and we've got existential. And when I saw this, I said, oh-ho, I have seen that before. Now, in the 80s, I think it was, a guy called John Suller, and it's written there on the board, wrote a book called Conceptual Graphs. You've probably heard about Venn diagrams. Did you do Venn diagrams at school? Yeah, well, that handles propositional logic. It handles a fragment of propositional logic. Venn diagrams sort of run out of steam once you get up to about six classes. But at any rate, John Sower wanted to support databases, he wanted to support natural language processing, he wanted a large representation language that could be written as nice looking graphs. And there's a pun here on graph as in a diagram and graph as in a network of things joined by edges. So he came up with this thing called conceptual graphs and wrote about it, and it turns out that the part that you can handle easily in a in this approach as conjunction and existential quantification. Negation makes real problems. So this is actually a theme. There's a group at Montpellier. Don't ask me to remember their names. There's a research group there who've been publishing a series of papers on existential conjunctive fragments of first-order logic. Now, what do I mean by that? Sorry if I keep going to the wrong computer. We've got literals, that's a predicate symbol, and some arguments. And the arguments in this fragment of logic are just variables. There are no constants and no functions. Or it could be a negated predicate applied to arguments. So a literal, so we've got an atomic formula, or the negation of atomic formula. It's a restricted version of negation, just like AL. And then you've got intersection or AND for formulas, and you've got existential quantifier. And Dr. Labenstein has introduced the concept of entailment. Does this thing entail? That means, is it true that in every model of alpha, beta is true? It's a model theory thing, not a proof theory thing. This question is decidable for this fragment of logic. Unfortunately, it's very, very hard. Don't ask me to explain what this means. There's a hierarchy depending on the number of quantifiers, basically. If we eliminate the negation, if we say you don't have negation at all, then the entailment problem is NP complete. It moves from somewhere way up here, worse than that, whereas it moves from way up here all the way down to here, not as far as we'd like. So one of the differences between AL and EL, AL allows you to negate an atomic concept, EL does not, and it makes the difference between tractability and intractability. We've got the same kind of thing in this richer logic here. So this existential conjunctive is something to watch out for. Now, there's a really interesting thing about EL. Because it doesn't have negation, it doesn't have disjointness, it therefore does not have disjointness, for example. If you keep on adding new facts about individuals being belonging to concepts and individuals standing in certain relationships, you never have to change your mind about something you already believe. You get new facts that you didn't have an opinion about before. You get new facts that you can infer from what you've been told, but you never have to say, oh, I used to believe this, now I don't. So with EL, no matter how many facts you add, you can't get a contradiction. Belief revision, you just add new consequences. And unfortunately, that means we can't say things like people aren't pets, but we can tell us, first of all, bottom isn't allowed, but there's nothing we can do that gets the same effect. Because if I tell you so-and-so is a person, and then I tell you so-and-so is a pet, that's guaranteed not to be a contradiction. EL does not handle contradiction. But one of the reasons why people got particularly interested in EL is that there's another thing that you might want to do, and it's particularly relevant to this question about constructing a large collection of facts. Suppose you've got... Let's take, for example, somebody's put in something using the concept ring or ring, somebody else has put in something
using the concept has, and you want to know if they're actually talking about the same thing, or if they're, if they have a common, you know, if they've got a common special case. And there's an operation, or at least there's an idea that crops up over and over again. It's called unification. And it's simply solving an equation. In some mathematical structure, the unification problem is you're given two expressions that contain constants and operators and variables. Can you find a substitution of values for variables that makes those two things equal? Now, this is very, very important in theorem proving. But here it's about saying, have we really got two different concepts here? So there's two slightly different things. One-way matching, if C can contain variables, it can fill in, but D doesn't. So this thing is, you can't change what D is, you can't refine that. That's called matching. But if they can both contain variables, then it's called unification. And by the way, this comes up in programming languages. Functional programming languages use matching as their primitive operation. The way that you take things apart is matching. Logic programming languages use unification. But as people, you can study matching and unification in general algebraic settings. If you know, for example, I mean, solving equations really is a special case of unification. So one of the things we ask about any particular mathematical structure is, okay, what's the unification problem like for this? Is it decidable? If you've got two things you want to unify them, is there a unique answer? Okay. Now, for example, in arithmetic, if I ask the question x plus y equals y plus x, that's true as it stands, but we can say things like, well, x equals 1, y equals 1, x equals 1, y equals 2, x equals 2, y equals... Okay. There are infinitely many ways to fill in x and y that make this thing true. So we talk about things like the most general unifier. Is there a substitution that makes these things equal such that all others are special cases of it? And there are problems where there is one unique, most general solution. There are problems where there's a finite number of them. And there's problems where there are infinitely many solutions. Okay. Now, these people, he's at Dresden, or was, have shown that both unification and matching are NP complete for EL. So it's doable, it can be done, but it's expensive. If you make one tiny change, if you have universal qualification value restriction instead of existential value restriction, it's still decidable, but it's X time complete. So here we've got something which is just on the edge, okay, or just on a complexity edge. It's so nice to have the universal value restriction, and I look at this and I say, is that really useful? Well, it's as much as you can afford if you care to do unification. Well, EL, I am on track here for time, good. EL is tractable. This is the big thing about EL. Unification is NP, but all of the other basic operations are polynomial time. So it's clearly sort of beginning to press up against a limit here. It's not really expressive. There are lots more things we'd like to say. And here is where we start to draw a connection to the remaining two lectures. We've got this thing called the Resource Description Framework, which was originally for describing things, so that you could say, for example, is that a porn site? Is this a website? Is this document biased with a right-wing view? Is it biased with a left-wing view? Whatever. So that but then people got ambitious and they came up with the web ontology language, which is actually a family of things. And why is it a family? Why is OWL a family? It's because of this complexity thing, the complexity expressiveness trade-off. There is a version, there is a fragment of OWL that is very nearly EL, but not quite. There's a fragment of OWL which is basically EL++. And there's a version of OWL which is totally intractable. I don't know why they bothered. I mean, the first time I saw that thing, I fell about laughing. I said, why would anybody who's interested in using this stuff define a language which they know is intractable? But they did. Okay. So you have to know, I'm warning you here, to beware of OWL. Make sure if you're using an application that's doing semantic web, make sure that the part that you're using is not just expressive enough for your needs, but tractable. And if it's not tractable, think about changing your needs. So what does EL++ do? Well, first of all, EL++ is the logic, not the notation, but the logic that underlies SNOMED clinical terms and the gene ontology. So there's several hundred thousand concepts, well over a million relationships. Several years ago, it was 1.4 million assertions of relationships. Now, when you're dealing with things that big, tractable really matters. Okay. In fact, tractable, you really, really don't want to be going quadratic. You really want things to be practically linear, because, you know, a million squared, forget it. So EL++ is actually quite rich. The formulas can mention individuals, can mention roles. Then they've got a distinction here. And this distinction is quite important in RDF, and it's a distinction that's familiar from relational databases. Okay. Did either of you do relational databases, ER diagrams? No idea. Entity relationship modeling talks about entities. So, student 77 takes. So you might have a student entity, and we might have a paper entity, and we've got a relationship between the student and that paper. But there are things to say about a student and things to say about a paper that are not modeled as entities. So we've got name, age, name, age, and get. There was a letter in the Otago Daily Times, I think it was yesterday. This guy said he'd graduated with a student debt of $28,000, and he had paid $23,000, and he now had a debt of $31,000. So despite paying nearly what he owed, he now owed more than when he started with, and he was now retiring. He was never going to be able to pay off his debt. I'm glad there were no student loans in my day. I'm really glad about that. But name is a string, not an entity. Age is a number, not an entity. Debt is a number of amount of money, not a... These things are values, not objects. And this might have a relationship with stuff in my body, so I'll get into that. So entity relationship modeling in databases distinguishes between entities, things that we might choose to think of as objects in the world, although it's difficult to, in what sense is cost 14 an object? I'm not sure. But there are things that we care to model as objects, put it that way. And there are properties like name and age and date and date and level, points, etc., that we might care to represent as numbers. So the title of this thing is not modeled as an entity, as an object. It's modeled as a value. EL++ and RDF reflect that. A feature is a partial function from individuals to concrete domains. What's a concrete domain? It's a thing like a measurement with units, or a number, or a string. Things that we're not modeling as objects, individuals. And we've got predicates over these concrete domains. And this is quite a significant, quite a significant extension, actually. So the concepts, we've got top and bottom, and we've got nominal. we can mention a particular individual as a concept. We've got conjunction, existential restriction. So this top and conjunction and we've also got concept names, atomic concept, I forgot to mention that, and concrete domains. So we've got EL plus we've got bottom, nominal, and concrete domain. So we can, this for example could be age greater than or equal to 21 would be a concept. We haven't seen that before. Here's what it does. A set of things in our domain such that it has these values and they stand in that relationship. So what can you put in the T-box? Concept inclusion, but there's this new role thing that should be over there. Role inclusion. Say the composition of these relations, these roles, is subsumed by that role. Okay. Now, composition here, we've said that before. Just a reminder, R composed of S equals XY such that there exists a Z, X, Z in R, and ZY. It's just Boolean matrix multiplication. But so, for example, if we needed to talk about, we could, for example, say that mother composed with sister is contained in aunt. That would be a role inclusion. Domain restriction. This is the thing I said I wanted to do before. We can say the domain of tens is contained in person. Range restriction, the range of tens is contained in pair. So we've got both of these things. And the role inclusion includes the case n equals 0. And we use the identity. We consider the identity relationship or the equality relationship, that's the identity for composition. And in the literature I hear about this, they tend to write it as E, but the E stands for equality. So we can actually say, for example here, that equality is contained in some relationship. So we could say, let's say, we could say, quality is contained in ancestor. Mother is contained in ancestor. And ancestor composed with ancestor is contained in ancestor. And this, in effect, says ancestor we can express the fact that ancestor is the transitive closure of father, union, mother, without having union or star in the language. We get the same thing by having all of these role inclusions.
What's a star?
The kleiner star, transitive closure. Have you met regular expressions?
Yeah.
Star meaning zero or more.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's the same thing. It really is the same thing.
Yeah.
It just means repetition in a definite number of times. So your ancestor, you start with yourself and you go up through your father or mother zero or more times. Anybody who reaches that way, you call them ancestor.
Yeah.
That's the planar star. Planar. That's the name of the logician who invented the notation. I can say we can get this effect without having the notation to say it because we can say these role inclusions. So role inclusions are very powerful. They make us express union, they make us express closure. And what can we put in our assertion box? Usual sorts of things. Now, role inclusions let us do all sorts of things. So we can say, for example, oh no, let's not do it quite that way. So you can, with facts like this, if we're told John is the father of Mary, Mary's father is John, John isn't dead. Does Mary have a relative who isn't dead? We get the answer yes, because father is a special case of parent, which is a special case of relative. Okay. We can do this in EL++, we can't do it in EL because EL doesn't include that or this for roles, and we can't do it in ALC. So this is weird. I mean, why might we need to do this in something like, for example, a medical ontology? Well, just off the top of my head, think about part of relationship. Here are some spectacles. You can take them apart. There's a screw there, there's a screw there. You can pop it, so we could take this apart into an earpiece, a screw, a connecting a frame and another screw. Another earpiece, another screw, and we could take the lenses out and we could take the nose pieces off. think they've got screws as well, but I'm not sure. All right, we could take that apart, and then we could put them back together. And we could take parts off. We could take, if there was another similar pair of frames, we could take the screws off one and put them in the other. The parts here are detachable and interchangeable. Whereas my fingertip is not a detachable part of my finger. If you take my fingertip away, arguably I don't have my finger anymore. You certainly can't take my finger and swap it for yours. Not only would it hurt, it probably wouldn't work. We'd probably reject, you know, our bodies would reject each other's fingers. So we've got parts. Here we've got this pen with a lip. Comes off, goes on. Comes off, goes on. Okay. They're not, as it happens, interchangeable. But so we've got detachable parts. We've got non-detachable parts. You've probably, if you read enough science fiction, seen the joke where somebody says irritably to a robot, "Give me a hand," and the robot unscrews its hand and gives it to it. For us, the hand is not a detachable part. "Give me a hand" doesn't mean, cannot mean, detach a hand and give it. But nonetheless, they're both, so detachable part and non-detachable part are both special kinds of part of. In normal operation, this thing needs all its pieces to work. If one of the screws was missing, the glasses would fall off my face. This would be no fun at all. Certainly wouldn't make them functional. And with human beings, well, some parts are more detachable than others. We can cut hair and it will grow back. We can clip nails and they'll grow back. But you can't clip fingers, they won't grow back. You can pull teeth out and it hurts, but the organism will be functional afterwards. You don't want to go around pulling fingers off, it's not the same thing at all. So there's more than one way to be a part. And some things you can remove somebody's appendix without killing them, but you can't remove their brain without killing them. So there's more than one way to be a part. And we don't necessarily want to model all of these things the same way. We might want to have this hierarchy of roles. Again, things like ownership and control. I house and feed, or rather my wife and I house and feed, our daughters and our pets. So there is a tending relationship here. Looking after children and looking after pets are not utterly different, but they are utterly different. We can sell our pets and we can't sell our daughters. Not unless you're in Nigeria and Boko, whatever their name is, are around. Just because they say it's legal doesn't make it right. It's a very evil thing indeed, but you know, we can't. We could eat our pets. People would be a bit disgusted with us, but there is, as far as I know, there's no law against eating budgies, provided they're killed mercifully. Well, our dog ate a budgie. It was the best budgie in the world. Really nice, bright, intelligent, friendly budgie. Got out of the cage one day, flew down the stairs within reach of the dog. The dog leapt and crunched. Still rather traumatic to remember. But it would certainly be a very evil thing to try and eat my daughters. So we've got a relationship here that's very similar. I have to look after these things. I've got to ensure they've got food and drink and suitable shelter and all that. But it's not the same. So we want to keep these relationships distinct in a knowledge base so that we don't get the database saying, "And what was the price for your daughter?" But we want to note the connection between them. We want to be able to say, "It's your job to make sure this person gets a meal. I bought my daughter a chicken and mushroom pie this morning on the way in." How is that different from buying my dogs and dog food? Well, actually, the difference is that she asked for it and the dog can't say exactly what she wants, but never mind. But I mean, there are similarities and there are differences. Because you want the differences, you want to model them differently. Because there are similarities, you want to express that. So, we can write hierarchies of equivalence, transitive roles, this is what I've just mentioned, reflexive roles, and we can express disjointness of concepts, which we couldn't do before. And now, with the nominal, we can do something that we could not do before. If we say that this set of individuals is subsumed by that set of individuals, and there's only one in each, the only way this can be true is if A and B are the same thing, different names for the same thing. So we can express equality of individuals. And with a disjointness, we can express inequality of individuals. And that means that we can express I have three pets like this way. I don't need to mention genus, I don't need to mention sex. I just say Lily isn't Jazzy, Lily isn't Shazzy, and Jazzy isn't Shazzy either. So they've got to be three distinct pets here. And we can do this in EL++, and we can't do it in ALC, and we can't do it in EL. Now, there's one little difficulty. There's this technical thing. We've got this idea of a T-box entailing a role inclusion. And so if there's a chain of role inclusions, this one is included in that one, 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 which is this one. So it's a transitive closure of these things. And here's this restriction. It's a very odd-looking restriction. If we have a role restriction in our T-box, and the T-box entails that this thing is contained in something, then the T-box must already have entailed that this thing ends up in the same concept. Basically, what we're saying here is that a role inclusion can't add further restrictions to the rightmost role in that composition. That's a weird little restriction, isn't it? It's very difficult to... I can't feel that as natural. But if you do have that restriction, the subsumption in EL++ is polynomial time. If you don't have that restriction, then it's undecidable. This kind of thing happens all the time. Some weird little restriction is what you need. In practice, this is not a burden. This is something we usually want anyway. And if we didn't, we can add the next, we can add the extra fat. I mentioned last week the algebra of binary relations, and I mentioned inverse. We can't add role inverse without losing tractability. It's a pain, but there you are. Now, where does most of this stuff come from? Well, a lot of the work on EL++ comes from Frank Bader and his colleagues. And I think this is a good time to stop. EL++, I said I wasn't going to be able to point you to anything and say, this is, well, it's great. Now, EL++ can, in fact, be extended in a few ways without losing everything. There's another paper by Frank Bader showing some of the extra things you can do. But this is... EL++ is a very good sort of... it's good enough for some very large knowledge bases. So I think EL++ is worth remembering. Now, what do I actually expect you to remember in the exam? that we've never done this before. You can't look at previous exam papers. So this is what I'm going to do in last year. What do I expect you to remember about all of this for the exam? Well, I haven't read the exam questions yet, so I don't quite know, so I'm telling myself here. I think it is reasonable for me to expect you to remember what you can and can't say in EL, because it's pretty small. It's reasonable for me to expect you to remember that subsumption, taking two concept expressions and saying, is this one a special case of that one, is one of the key things that we want to do. And I do expect you to remember that the issue is this operation undecidable, decidable, but hard, or polynomial time? And so why do we have lots, and the other thing I expect is why do we have lots of different description logics with arcane names and different combinations of things? Because we can't put everything in and get something that's tractable. And sometimes you want one particular thing you can say, and sometimes you want something else. That's why we need multiple things. I certainly do not ask you to remember this restriction. One thing, I think I've got it slightly wrong. But this is the important thing, that we want something that isn't just expressive enough to let us say what we want to say. It's tractable enough to let us ask what we want to ask. And we're talking here about the practicality of very large concept bases indeed. Concept bases which are so big that no one human being could possibly have made them. There's a guy called Douglas Hofstetter who's written a number of very interesting books. Escher, Gödel, Bach, and Eternal Golden Bread was one of them. Mind's Eye, with a capital I, was another. Whole lot of very insightful things. He had a thing called the Psyche Project. They were going to try and build inside a computer a knowledge base that approached what you might expect a human being to know. There is still a thing called Open Psyche out there. At one point in the construction of, and this thing was active, you put in facts and it would draw inferences and ask questions to try and help. And at one point it came up with the question, am I human? It wasn't an unreasonable question. You know, psyche believes things, humans believe things. Is psyche human or not? I was just talking to the 326 class about how do you know when a program is right, and how hard should you work to determine this, and when should you worry about how much memory your program uses, and so on. If you're making a knowledge base about, let's say, the people in some club, there aren't going to be that many people. Pretty much anything you do, you can probably do it by exhaustive search. When you're dealing with something like medical terminology, this is something that affects people all around the world. The SNOMED ontology was originally constructed by the American pathologists and another group in the United Kingdom, and it's now administered by the United Nations. It's used in dozens of countries. Mistakes in that affect people all around the world. And if there's important information in there that can't be got out, that's indirectly harming millions and millions of people all around the world. So some of these things, we really do care about soundness. We do care about whether we can tell whether the database is consistent. And we do care about being able to get information out in a practical amount of time. Logic is out there in the real world doing a real job of work. It's not just for university anymore.